This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, we're going to be talking about healthcare reform, and my guest is none other than Wendell Potter, the former insurance industry PR guy who worked for Humana and Cigna and turned whistleblower, and who now works for the Center for Media and Democracy at prwatch.org. You might have seen him on Bill Moyers. You might have read his blockbuster testimony to Congress earlier this year. You might even have heard Barack Obama allude to him in his recent healthcare speech before Congress. Well, Wendell Potter's right here in the studio with me now. Wendell Potter, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thanks, Matt.
Well, let's start with that recent speech by the president. How did you react when he all of a sudden alluded to you? I mean, I jumped up in my chair because I'd read the testimony that he was referring to, but how did it strike you?
You know, I was in the gallery. I was a congressman had given me a ticket to come to the speech, and I thought, well, this is neat. I used to be a reporter, and I used to cover Congress, but I had never been to a joint session of Congress. And to be in the gallery and to hear the president quote me was just beyond – it was indescribable. I didn't know it was coming. I had no idea he was going to be doing it. Didn't even know he had paid any attention to me. So it was quite a thrill.
What was it like to be in the gallery when that representative called the president of the United States a liar?
You know, that was so startling. And the guy was sitting not too far from where I was in the gallery, and I could see, you know, the hubbub around him after he had done that. It was just startling. I'd never seen anything like it, and I don't think anyone had. It was just unbelievable. I almost thought of saying, I know I wasn't going to say anything, but I just thought of saying, who are you calling a liar? It is people like you and the shills for the industry who really are the fearmongers and the liars, in my view.
And you talked about some of that in your testimony to Congress earlier this year. You used to work for the industry in PR. And why do you think the industry people are the liars in this?
Because of money. We're talking about billions of dollars here, and a lot of money is at stake. And they have learned that over the years, they need to scare people, scare people away from reform. And they've done it for many years. It's not just the insurance industry. The AMA and other organizations have done the same thing. They found that scare tactics work just like negative campaigns often work, and that's why.
I mean, the scare tactic about socialized medicine or government-run health care has more legs than I thought it would, because, after all, 87 million people get their coverage, get single-payer health care, get government health care. I'm talking about people on Medicare or Medicaid or at the VA, for instance. And yet that arrow still has some sting.
It does, and the industry knows that, and that's why you keep hearing it. The industry does – spends a lot of your premium dollars and mine, if you're privately insured, doing focus groups and a lot of survey work to find out what messaging works, what words and phrases resonate, and the impact that those words have on people. And they know that terms like a government takeover of the healthcare system and slippery slope towards socialism, they know what effect that has on a big segment of the population.
They probably also know that a decent percentage or indecent percentage of the people on Medicare don't even realize it's government-paid Medicare, because you had these people, of course, saying, keep the government hands off my Medicare.
You know, exactly right. I was at a town hall in New Jersey just last week, and there were a lot of people, the teabaggers were there, or the people who were there not to listen but to express their points of view, and they had signs that they were able to bring into the auditorium. But there were some elderly women near the front, and they had signs, hands off my health care. And they, you know, I'm confident they were Medicare beneficiaries.
What do you make of these teabaggers? I mean, at the beginning, some people on the left said it was all AstroTurf. These people were either paid for or bussed in by industry. But that can't be the totality of those people. There's got to be some ideological segment that has been ginned up to show up.
It's very true. A lot of people who are there because they it is ideological for them. They want to express their points of view because they are just opposed to any more government. That's the thing for a lot of people. Anything that might seem to indicate that there would be more government intrusion or that would lead to higher taxes, they're just against, number one. At that same town hall, there was a woman who came up to me afterwards, and she's quite indignant. She said, I wasn't paid by anybody to be here. I had made some comments in my remarks about how the industry is able to manipulate public opinion. And I was thinking, well, of course they didn't pay you. They didn't have to pay you. The money went to the PR firms that funded the front groups and that had the contacts with the Rush Limbaughs and the Glenn Becks and the Sean Hannitys of the world. That's where the money went, not to Rush Limbaugh directly, but to the PR firms and the connections they have to incite people, to get them there.
And you've called these PR groups that are set up to propagate the insurance industry's message, Wendell Potter, you've called them almost invisible persuaders, just for that reason, isn't it?
Oh, he's exactly right. And it's having been in the public relations field for quite a long time, I know exactly how it works. You know, when I first got into the profession, even in college, I studied public relations. I had certainly a different perspective as a student on public relations than I did as a practitioner in the latter part of my career. But that's exactly what happens. It's not so much relating to your public anymore or communicating in a two-way communications kind of thing. It's more about message manipulation for a lot of these people.
But go back to that New Jersey town hall meeting and that woman who was so indignant. After you explained that, you know, she wasn't paid directly to get there, I mean, still you're telling her that she's being duped. And how did she react to that?
It wasn't willing to listen, and that I found that to be the case for a lot of people. They weren't there to listen at all. They were just there to disrupt and to express their point of view. I'm really glad that I was there because I'd heard about these disruptions at town halls, and I guess it was democracy in action to a certain extent. And you know, there were people on the far left who were there to express their points of view too. And during my remarks, I really was having to shout because there were people who were wanting me to get off the stage so the congressman could get up there and they could ask questions of the congressman. And then the people who were there wanting to listen to me were saying, "Shut up, shut up." So it was just a kind of a cacophony. It was very interesting.
How do you think the far right that have jammed these town hall meetings, how have they affected the debate, do you think?
I think they had the effect of attracting a lot of media attention. I think that was the main objective, was to get the media focused on covering those and making policymakers hopefully think that a large segment of the population is now concerned about reform. That was the ultimate intent, and I think that was achieved because that's what we read about during much of August were the town halls and the disruptions there.
On the other hand, and you're a PR guy, so you would know this better than I would. I got the sense in watching that, you know, for middle America, this is not going to play real well. Middle America doesn't like this kind of rudeness. And so I wonder if to some extent it might have rebounded against them.
I think it did. And I thought that as it was going along. I thought that, you know, for a while this would work, but I think after a while people don't appreciate this. Yeah, I think by and large Americans don't like rudeness, don't like that disruption. And I think it really is backfiring on them. And I think in talking to a couple of congressmen, including a couple of blue dogs that I've met and have been to at least one of their town halls, one was Congresswoman Kathy Dahlkemper of Western Pennsylvania. Erie is the big city in her district, but she was saying that her resolve is greater to now support the public option than it had been before. I mean, she's heard from a lot of people, but those disruptions didn't sway her. In fact, I think the whole episode, I think all that she saw during the month of August just reinforced her need or her desire to vote for some what I think she hopes is going to be real reform.
I'm speaking with Wendell Potter. He's the former insurance industry PR guy who worked for Humana and Cigna. And then after leaving the insurance companies, he basically became a whistleblower and revealed to the world and testified before Congress and talked to Bill Moyers about how really the world works in the insurance industry. He now works for the Center for Media and Democracy at PRWatch.org. Well, let's talk about what the future looks like here with health insurance reform, or maybe just healthcare reform, and those may be two different things. In Obama's, what do you make of the substance of Obama's recent speech?
I thought substantively it was pretty good. I liked the speech. I felt that he needed to try to remind the American public why we're having this debate in the first place. Because I think with all the publicity that, or the news coverage we saw of the town halls, that that the reason for having this debate and doing what Congress is trying to do had been lost for a while. And I think he did a pretty good job of reminding people. I think that he needed to connect with people on an emotional level more than he's done in the past, and I think he did that as well. I think we saw the Obama as an orator last, you know, that last speech, the joint session of Congress that we hadn't seen in a while. So I thought from that perspective, it was effective.
You know, I agree with you, Wendell Potter, on that this was the moral and the emotional case for and the logical case for health care reform, and also he did a good job of tying it to traditional American values of big-heartedness, which I guess was the term, or large-heartedness that he attributed to Ted Kennedy. But when I got down to the specifics of the speech, it began to distressed me the more I looked at it over the last several days. And one of those specifics was the public option, which I think he all but, you know, sawed the plank out from underneath it when he didn't make a really strong defense of it. He said, we can do this, instead of saying we must do this. And then he said, well, we can always have co-ops or a trigger. What did you make of that aspect?
I was disappointed. When he was talking about the public option initially, he was making a pretty good case for it, and I think there's a good case that can be made for it. But as you pointed out, when he was talking about the other possible options, that clearly was a signal that he's very willing to sign a bill without it, and that distressed me because during the campaign he was very much in favor of a public option, and he was alone among the leading candidates in opposing an individual mandate. And now he looks like he's swapping there.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about that. What's wrong with an individual mandate? Why shouldn't individuals be forced to purchase insurance?
If there's no public option, I think I have a lot of problem with that, because that means that you will have no alternative but to, if you're not eligible for a public program that already exists, you'll have no alternative but to buy your coverage, and I would say overpriced coverage, from a private insurance company, which in the industry is now dominated by for-profit companies. That's what the problem I have with it, and that was the problem the president had with it during the campaign. Why would you force people to buy something they can't afford? Now, the solution, of course, is to give people subsidies to buy. But I have a problem with that, too, because our tax dollars are going to be subsidizing premiums that will go to these for-profit health insurance companies.
So essentially, we'll be subsidizing the insurance companies that caused the problem in the first place.
And what
is to stop, if there's no public option, what is to stop the insurance companies from jacking up prices?
There's not going to be anything that'll stop them. What they will do, under the guise of offering affordable coverage, they will offer premiums or some policies that presumably offer good coverage. But buyer beware here. I think that what we will see is that they will offer these so-called affordable premiums, but that's not the same as affordable health care. That means that if you are paying a relatively small amount or comparatively small amount on premiums, you will have to pay quite a bit out of pocket, a lot more out of pocket. And that, to me, is not the way to go. And that's one of the reasons I left the industry, as a matter of fact, because I thought that the shift of the way the industry is going to shift more of the financial burden onto the shoulders of working men and women is not sustainable. And I think that what the industry may achieve here in this legislation is having the government help it to sustain the system we've got for a longer period of time.
Wendell Potter, let's talk a little bit more about why you left the industry and then why you started to speak up. I've read you had an epiphany at an outdoor healthcare event. Do you want to talk briefly about that?
I will. I was visiting parents in Tennessee, where I grew up, and picked up the local newspaper. I was a reporter there many, many years ago, and there was a story about this healthcare expedition that was being held up Highway 23 in Wise County, Virginia, which is in the southwestern part of the state, southern Appalachian part of the world, coal mining, strip mining area. I decided to just drive up there. I was curious, and I, to this day, do not know why I did it, but it was now I'm grateful that it did, because going there, walking through the fairground gates, it was held at the Wise County Fairgrounds, was just walking through. The immediate scene was one that I was not prepared for, and it was just stunning to see hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people standing in line, and it was raining, waiting to get care. And I found out later a lot of them were being treated in barns and in animal stalls that other volunteers had disinfected, you know, a few days before. This was care being provided by doctors who were volunteering their time over 3 days to try to meet the needs of these people, many of whom, by the way, were insured.
It sounds like it was a scene out of the third world that it conjures up in your mind.
It was. I remember thinking immediately that what country is this? It just is almost like being in a movie set or something that was so un-American, so unlike anything I had ever experienced before. That it was like being there were a lot of the treatment areas were tents that had been set up, so it looked like mash units, or you thought maybe you could have imagined that these were refugees or these were it was a war torn country or a third world country, a developing country, because of the great need that we saw there. In fact, the group that was organized that provides this or organizes these events started doing this in developing countries, taking doctors, flying them to remote Amazon villages and villages in Africa to provide care to people who really were in remote locations and didn't have access to any kind of care, but they saw this great need in the U.S.
And you had known that, intellectually, that there were 45 million, 46 mm-hmm. million Americans without health insurance and tens of millions who are underinsured, and yet seeing just a few hundred up front, not intellectually with your brain reading a study, but yeah, with your heart,
yeah,
and your eyes, make a bigger difference. What does that tell you?
Well, it tells me that I want to try to get the president and his administration, members of Congress, to see this. There will be others that this group will be holding over the next several weeks. One actually is being held in Tennessee, not too far from where I went to school at the University of Tennessee, and it happens to be the home county of Nancy Ann DeParle, who is the president's head of healthcare reform. And I happened to be able to have a conversation with her, and I pointed it out to her, and she said, "Oh, that's where I grew up." And I said, "I know that." And I've talked to some members of Congress, and it's possible that there might be a congressional delegation, or at least a few members of Congress, that goes to see this. You cannot help but be affected when you see something like that.
And yet you took pictures of the event, and you went back to headquarters, corporate headquarters, and you showed some of your colleagues, and how did they react?
Well, I was almost, well, those, that's interesting. I don't know how to describe this, except they were a few people were interested in seeing my photographs and whether I was a good photographer or not, whether I'd really captured it. But 15 minutes later, everybody was off doing what they had been doing before. It didn't really register for most people.
I mean, this is a problem we have. You've written that you still respect your former colleagues, and I wonder why, because you explain how they have systematically tried to use the expression "screw people out of their coverage." And so why would you say you still respect your colleagues?
I think respect is probably not the right word. I think I have said that. I know I did say that at least once, and I don't know that I don't respect what they do and what I did necessarily. I understand it. Maybe that's a better way of putting it. And I can and I like those people personally. They didn't do anything to me, and it was a very collegial atmosphere most of the time. So it's an atmosphere that I was a part of for a long time, and you just don't turn your back on it and say I hate that and hate those people. You form personal relationships with a lot of these people over the years, and I don't think anyone is, maybe I'm wrong, is inherently evil. We're all flawed people, and I think that's just how I see it.
But they were in a system. They were working for a system. They were being rewarded by a system quite handsomely that was doing a lot of harm to people. I mean, it's analogous to, maybe not as extreme, to people working in the tobacco industry who may be mm-hmm. decent family people, but they're, involved in yeah. getting 435 million people, yeah. 435,000 people a year killed.
Yeah.
So that's – what was the worst thing the insurance companies did when you were there, or one of the worst insurance industry practices that, looking back on it now, really gets you?
Well, the practices the things that insurance companies do to enhance shareholder value, and I'm, not every insurance company is a for-profit one, but it's the industry is now dominated by actually just seven very, very large healthcare companies that I often call a cartel because they are so dominant. The masters are Wall Street investors and Wall Street analysts, and to meet those expectations, which they have to demonstrate every 3 months that they're striving to do that, they have to be very careful with what they call medical management. And among the things they do there is making sure that they don't pay too many claims. They review claims very carefully, and they often will not approve a request that's made by doctors. They will often deny or not pay a claim that comes through for some technicality often. But I think the larger sins are canceling or rescinding policies of people who have been paying their premiums for years and years and years, and when they get sick or injured and file claims that will often trigger a review of the application that the person filled out. And the review is, the intent of that is to see if the person might have not disclosed something that was pertinent to a pre-existing condition.
This was an example of that Obama gave in his recent speech about the woman who had breast cancer and was denied treatment at least for several months because she had forgotten to report that she had acne
at some point.
That's right. That is a case I think that almost every American can relate to and be appalled by.
Yeah.
Now, at least rhetorically, it sounds like the insurance companies are willing to go along with legislation that would force them to stop that, force them to agree to cover people with pre-existing conditions and not have any rescissions. Now, I'm a pretty cynical person, I guess, and I'm wondering, why are they going along with that, or are they going to find a way to weasel out of that?
Well, your word rhetorically is apt there. They said the same things in 1993 and 94, and I can point to the congressional testimony where they were saying pretty much verbatim the same things they're saying now, that they're willing to do this or make this or that concession. That is part of what I call their duplicitous campaigns. They will tell you what they think you and policymakers want to hear, and that they're good guys and are willing to make changes for the good of the cause or for the benefit of reform. I think at this point they think the chances of reform are greater this time than ever before, and I think they're probably right. And I think they would be willing to do these things because all of them would have to abide by new regulations. So everybody would in the industry would be playing by the same rules. What they would gain, though, would be millions and millions and millions of new members. So that's why they'd be willing to do this. They know they're getting a lot more people to cover, many of whom will be young people who are healthy. They'll be getting premiums for those people, many of those premiums coming from the federal government because most people who are uninsured can't afford the premiums, so they'll have to have some government subsidy.
So they'll be getting premiums from young, healthy people that they'll never have to pay out on,
right.
And that'll go straight to the profit line.
That's right. It goes straight to the profit line. And the other thing is, and I want to hopefully make this point to members of Congress over the coming days and weeks, is that they will agree to this, but that will not mean that the pressure from Wall Street will go away. In fact, with more people in the system, they will be looking for new and creative ways to avoid paying claims and to making sure that they're meeting Wall Street's expectations.
Yeah, that's what concerns me. Wendell Potter is my guest. He's now working for the Center for Media and Democracy at PRWatch.org. He used to work for Humana and Cigna, and he has been the most credible critic of the insurance industry because he came from within. You now, if there's no public option, I don't believe there's going to be a public option. Blue Dog Democrats are talking about co-ops, as though that's going to be a solution. You've called co-ops a sheer fantasy. Why is that?
Because I think the idea may actually have come from the insurance industry because if it becomes part of law, there's just no chance that they can be created with enough substance and size to be able to compete with these big companies. The industry has consolidated significantly over the past several years. As the president noted in the speech, some markets are dominated by very, very large companies, sometimes like 75 to 90% in a state. A co-op is not going to be able to take business away from dominant players like that have good for the insurance company contracts with providers. They get those contracts because they can demonstrate they got a lot of people, and they can deliver patients to doctors and hospitals. For example, a startup co-op just will not ever be able to scale up large enough to really compete in markets. It just is not going to happen.
So we're going to be junking a public option for something that is going to be just incredibly insignificant.
Oh, absolutely. Incredibly, very incredibly insignificant.
Now, we only have about a minute left, Wendell Potter. I'm from a psychological standpoint or a social network standpoint, it's hard to leave your circle. You've left your circle. I'm wondering how hard that has been for you and whether you've been ostracized.
There's a transition period. This was kind of a two-step process. When I left, I left and didn't know what I was going to do. I called it a mini-retirement. But it was months later that I decided to speak out. And during that time, I was beginning to separate from my old friends. And I found out that they were people I saw at work, but they weren't really close friends. So it's not been a big deal. I've met so many good people since then that I enjoy being with. I don't have any regrets.
And you haven't been physically threatened?
No, I haven't.
Well, I wish you the best of luck and safety, of course, in this incredible, powerful campaign you're waging for real health care reform in this country. Wendell Potter has been my guest today. He works for the Center for Media and Democracy, which can be reached at PRWatch.org. Wendell Potter, thanks so much.
Thank you, Matt.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.